The headlines. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again criticizes the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Millions of Americans lose their jobless benefits as U.S. President Donald Trump refuses to sign a coronavirus relief bill into law. Also in the headlines, Palestinian officials call on the U.S. Security Council to act against the rising Israeli settler violence in the occupied West Bank. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has lashed out at the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Rouhani said the U.S. has caused trouble for Iran to acquire vaccines through what he called wicked activities. He said that Iran will do its utmost to obtain an effective and reliable vaccine despite American sanctions. The president assured that Iran has installed the proper equipment to store any type of COVID-19 vaccine. Tehran has time and again complained that U.S. financial sanctions are blocking its access to drug and medical supplies. The number of deaths from the coronavirus has surpassed 190,000 in Brazil as the fast-spreading disease continues to rage across the country. Brazilian Health Ministry reported near 500 fatalities and nearly 23,000 new cases on Saturday. Brazil has over 7.4 million infections. In Mexico, more than 9,600 people contracted the virus in the last 24 hours. It also registered more than 665 new fatalities, pushing the overall death toll to nearly 122,000. Mexico has already started mass coronavirus vaccination, along with several other Latin American countries. In the U.S., the number of fatalities has surpassed 330,000, while its total cases are nearing 19 million. The U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic. U.S. police say they have found possible human remains near the site of a huge blast that tore through the city of Nashville, Tennessee on Friday. Drake said the origin of the tissue remains unclear and that there were no confirmed fatalities. He added that a possible motive for the blast was unknown. Three people suffered minor injuries after a parked motorhome in downtown Nashville exploded at dawn. The blast came just moments after officers responded to reports of gunfire in the area and discovered a recreational vehicle. Police said the explosion appeared to be an intentional act. Correspondent in Washington, D.C. says that many questions remain unanswered about the incident in Nashville.
There's so many variables here. If you look at Nashville, Tennessee, why Nashville? I mean, there's so many other cities. If they wanted to make a political statement or conduct some type of terrorism or something like that, you would think it would be a city like New York or D.C. or Miami or Los Angeles even. Not really Nashville, Tennessee. And the way that it warned people, like I said before, why would you warn people and not only just warn them, but give them a 15-minute warning? Why even 15 minutes? And then if it was, according to how other people reported the incident, that it was 15 minutes and then another 15 minutes, equaling 30 minutes, what happened there? There are just so many questions right now as police try to put together this crime scene. They say they found human remains, and then, of course, they're going to try to identify who those remains belong to. As far as any other deaths, it's really uncertain because, again, this was a very big blast. So a lot of the evidence, of course, is going to be destroyed in the immolation of this bomb and the detonation of this explosive. Again, the motivation here is why it could be widespread. There just doesn't seem to be any tight correlation for something politically motivated. But of course, this could have been someone who was mentally unstable, and they could have used any reason under the sun to try to justify why they should have detonated a van in Nashville, Tennessee.
Millions of Americans have lost their jobless benefits amid U.S. President Donald Trump's refusal to sign the coronavirus relief bill into law. Trump urged U.S. lawmakers to make a number of changes to the measure, including bigger direct payments to families and individuals. He criticized the bill for offering too much money to special interest, cultural projects, and foreign aid. The U.S. Labor Department says that Trump's injection of the bill would leave nearly 14 million Americans without unemployment benefits. The move can also result in a partial government shutdown next week. Lawmakers agreed on a $2.3 trillion pandemic aid and spending package last week after months of wrangling. In the U.S., record levels of Americans are struggling with unemployment after they lost their jobs due to the outbreak of the coronavirus. The British think tank says that China will overtake the U.S. as the world's biggest economy by 2028 after outperforming its rival during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Center for Economics and Business Research said in its annual report that the pandemic and its economic fallout have changed the rivalry in favor of China. The U.S. is the worst-hit country by COVID-19 in terms of both deaths and infections. The UK-based consultancy group said that China has skillfully managed the coronavirus pandemic with a strict early lockdown. It said that Beijing bounced back quickly from the effects of COVID-19 and would grow by 5.7% a year from 2021 to 2025, before slowing down to 4.5% a year from 2026 to 2030. Author and columnist Aino Tangen says that China is economically more strong to make up for its lost revenues from imports after the U.S. boycotted Chinese products.
Right now, with these tech wars, they're simply pushing China to be less reliant on the U.S., therefore buying less U.S. products. Who is that hurting? It's not hurting China. China will emerge from it with their own independent IP, and they'll continue to produce. Yeah, unfortunately, the U.S., many of the firms there will start shedding employees, and these are high-paying employees, which are going to continue to go down. Donald Trump chose to politicize what is, in essence, a medical scientific issue. China, in essence, followed its scientists. It did. At the time, remember, we go back 9 months, people were complaining that China was taking draconian measures, and they were being criticized widely across the world for imposing this lockdown. But it turns out that this was really the only way to do it. Now, one of the big issues, which for some reason no one is willing to talk about, is tracing. Right now, if you're tracing in China, they do it automatically. You have, anytime you go into an establishment, even your home apartment base, you will be scanned.
Hello, welcome to the News Review. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has urged the UN Security Council to act against the rising Israeli settler violence in the occupied West Bank. The ministry said that a spike in attacks by Israeli settlers over the last week is aimed at terrorizing the defenseless Palestinians and stealing their land. It noted that the main objective of Israeli settlers is to gradually achieve a greater settlement block and, quote, Israelize more Palestinian areas. The ministry criticized the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump and held it responsible for the rise in tensions in occupied territories. It warned that the violence weakens the chances of ending the Palestinian-Israeli conflict based on the so-called two-state solution. Mona Kandil, a correspondent, joins us from occupied Ramallah, and Saad Nim is a professor of political science who joins us from Birzeit University, also from occupied Ramallah. All right, Mona, first over to you. Tell us more about what the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has said, and that is the rising Israeli settler violence.
Well, according to the Palestinian Foreign Ministry and the statement issued by the Palestinian Foreign Ministry, the settlers' attacks fall within the framework of the objective, which aims to achieve and impose a gradual and effective annexation of all areas in the occupied West Bank, classified as Area C, that should be part of the Palestinian state in the future. However, what's going on, the settlers continue to terrorize the Palestinian farmers and villagers in areas close to the illegal settlements. These demonstrations and these attacks by the settlers came after there was attacks by settlers from the so-called Hilltop Youth Group. Those are young Israeli settlers coming from the settlements to terrorize and attack the young Palestinians in the villages in Nablus and Beit Lahem in areas near Ramallah. During these attacks, one of the settlers passed away after the Israeli police were chasing their vehicles, and thus the settlers were very angry. Thus, they continued to attack the Palestinians. During the last week, there was an escalation of attacks and oppression by the settlers against the Palestinians, unarmed people living in the villages and towns all over the occupied West Bank.
Well, Sadnam, you know, when we talk about Israeli settler violence, it is quite astonishing to see the level of anger and violence that these settlers actually exercise on Palestinians. Do you think that this is something that is actually groomed through the schooling that they receive to exercise such violence against Palestinians, given the fact that this is not their land and it's you know, an occupation, that they're living on occupied land?
Right. As a matter of fact, we know that the settlers, we can categorize them into two categories. Part of that category is the ideological settlers who believe that all this land is theirs and Palestinians should not be anyway in the land, and they are going on with their actions to ethnically cleanse Palestine from its own inhabitants. The other category is what we call them the economic settlers. Those, they came for the benefits of the settlements, reduction in taxes and more benefits for people who are living in settlements. Our problem mainly comes from the ideological part. Those who are, you know, forming some groups, terrorist groups, among the settlers, and they are attacked frequently and regularly, attack the Palestinian villages, attack the Palestinian farmers. And just recently, in the last 3 days, there were a kind of a huge amount of attacks all over the West Bank. They were going in marches in the streets, and they were attacking the cars, they are attacking the passengers, they were attacking the villages, and they are coming out of their senses. The whole thing is that they know that they are in the last or final episode, last month for Trump administration, and they know that they can get away with whatever they are doing against the Palestinians. The whole idea for them is to grab more land and to force the Palestinian to back behind the lines that they're sitting, and especially that they are trying to enlarge the settlements and to confiscate more land from the Palestinians during that area. The point for the settlers now is to create a huge settlements block in the area of Nablus to connect it with the Jordan Valley in order to confiscate all that land. And it's part of the plan to annex 30% of the Jordan Valley, or 30% of the West Bank, to make these huge settlements blocks.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's Said Nim, professor of political science at Prizren University. We'd also like to thank Mona Kandil, our correspondent from Occupied Ramallah, and that brings us to an end of this news review. Welcome back. The Israeli regime has carried out fresh airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas of the besieged Palestinian coastal enclave. In a statement, the Israeli military said that its warplanes hit three Hamas targets early on Saturday. It claimed that the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas denounced the attacks, which targeted a children's hospital and also a rehabilitation center. It underlined that such moves would not break the Palestinians' will, but would rather strengthen their resistance and resolve to fight for their legitimate rights. The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing similar accusations. Earlier, correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, gave us more details on the Israeli attacks.
Israeli fighter jets attacked central Gaza and also the eastern part of Gaza City. During this airstrike, Israeli fighter jets damaged the children's hospital and also damaged a center that treats the disabled. At least one child was injured. Israeli fighter jets used at least six rockets against the Gaza Strip, and also used artillery fire to attack areas in the east of Deir al-Balah. This has been a grim reminder to people of Gaza of the 2008 war. Around this time, in 2008, Israel waged a 22-day war on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of people in the tiny enclave. Since then, Israel waged two more wars and caused huge destruction, a huge loss of life for nearly 2 million people in the Gaza Strip.
Lebanese media say that a bomb has exploded on the way of an Israeli petrol convoy near the borders between the occupied Palestinian territories and southern Lebanon. We are now joined by our correspondent in Beirut for more on the story. Mariam, what do you have for us?
Well, it seems to be a bit blurry for now because what we know from the local media, especially the Al-Manar correspondent who is continuously at the border, he reported that he heard loud sounds of explosions on the Palestinian side of the border near the village of Al-Daisa, which is right at the border, one of the furthest villages in that area. And what they did hear was sounds of ambulances. They heard sounds of Israeli soldiers. But other than that, we don't have clear images. And as you know, usually the Israelis keep a lockout when it comes to issues related to the Israelis. Whether this was an operation, an accident, something that was orchestrated by the Israelis, as we had in the past, it's not something we can really figure out right now. The Israelis could probably be have reached the state of like the boy who cried wolf. So we were not really sure exactly what happened, but people did hear loud explosions. This is what we have for now. Of course, if there had been any operation conducted by Hezbollah, which everyone is still waiting for because Hezbollah has pledged to retaliate for martyrs inside Syria that were martyred as a result of Israeli strikes on Syria over around a year ago, then this is something that we are waiting for, but we don't know if it will be a retaliation by Hezbollah. Hezbollah will definitely issue a statement. This is what Hezbollah usually does when they do have operations. Of course, we will know more details from Hezbollah's Secretary General. He will be speaking tomorrow in a comprehensive interview. We probably might get an idea on that if we do not have anything from Hezbollah from now until tomorrow, because this is what happened last time. We waited, there was complete silence from Hezbollah's side, and it turned out that the Israelis were only orchestrating some sort of an operation, saying that Hezbollah had already responded. They wanted to get over with that. And as you know, they are so much high alert from the Israeli side near the southern border, because they are still, of course, apprehending that there could be a retaliation from Hezbollah at any time. Of course, that they cannot quite precisely know exactly when Hezbollah will respond, but this retaliation will definitely happen.
Thank you very much for that. Mariam Saleh there, talking to us from Beirut. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has slammed Israel's latest attack on the country, saying such acts of aggression will not go without consequences. The remarks came in a letter sent to the UN Secretary General and the President of the UN Security Council in reaction to Israel's Friday airstrikes in Hama countryside. The letter stressed that continuous support from the U.S. and some members of the Council has encouraged Israel to push ahead with its aggressive approach. Damascus condemned Israeli attacks as a flagrant violation of U.N. Security Council resolutions. It also called on the Council to assume its responsibility in preventing Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, Russia criticized Israeli airstrikes on Syria, saying that such actions, quote, further destabilize the complicated regional situation. And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
Old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just to, so my nana can rest and I can rest and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. Next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They'd work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums, and their swags and everything used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes. Everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white, or bleached white, where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
mainly headache at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated, and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. It's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. I put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this. And it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it. And I've just got to watch him. And I don't like to. I've got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself. It's hard.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and, I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles.
stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. So the pandemic is continuing strongly and steadily. I found that the greatest company almost any of us could have during this lockdown is books. And I'm not just saying that myself, I mean, a lot of my friends have expressed it, and also Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam has said it: when in pandemic, read books. Well, that's not exactly what he said, but it was something around those lines. I'll explain how and why after we hear a beautiful story regarding one of the greatest book-related achievements of our time. We'll be right back.
What's the title of today's story? How Ayatollah Osman Najafi Marashi Established the Library. One prominent scholar and authority on Islam called Ayatollah Osman Sayyid Marashi established a famous library in the city of Qom in Iran. He did this with his own personal effort by toiling hard for many years. Libraries play a very important role in causing awareness to the people, giving the people a good hobby and pastime, to spread good virtues, to be a source of pleasure, for the preservation of our culture and for the continuation of our culture and knowledge. It is due to all these reasons that our scholars toiled hard to establish public and private libraries and preserved valuable and ancient manuscripts in it. The doors of this library, this famous library, were open since 1394 AH. Sayyid Marashi didn't get much financial assistance in establishing this library. In many of the books in this library, there is a caption in which the Sayyid has written that he bought the particular book in question by praying and fasting on behalf of people who had died and whose relatives paid for these acts of worship. This is called Salat of Istijara. How great are these scholars who use each and every opportunity to do something which would help them in the life hereafter. Sayyid Marashi bought some great and rare books by praying on behalf of the dead, and sometimes a sum total of 2 years' prayers in conditions of hunger and extreme fatigue. May Allah bless his soul.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So back to the hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. He didn't exactly say when in during pandemics read books. His Eminence has said a person who finds comfort in books has not lost any sort of comfort and tranquility in their lives, because books are really good companions, mostly because they teach you stuff. And the greatest companion, as again our narrations teach us, is one who increases our knowledge. By book, we don't necessarily mean any kind of books, because obviously there are books out there that not only do they not increase our knowledge, but they could harm us in many ways. So just because something is between two covers and it's written on papers doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be good for us. By book, obviously, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam meant books that would increase our knowledge, increase our piety, increase our connection with God. These books don't necessarily have to be a hadith book or fiqhi books. They could be books about us, you know, self-motivational books or beautiful novels, historical novels or biographies that give us a better perspective at life, tell us about the lives of really successful people, tell us about history, because again, Imam Ali alayhi salam did study into history a lot, or he had a lot of knowledge regarding history, as he has said himself, because history is the greatest teacher and it's always bound to repeat itself. The more familiar we make ourselves with the life of people who came before us, the more we will know how to deal with situations that present themselves to us, i.e. pandemics. This pandemic is obviously not the first pandemic the world has faced. I mean, plagues are really famous. Books have been written about it. Actually, The Plague was one of the books that I reread parts of during this pandemic, and I enjoyed every word of it. I suggest it to our beloved listeners. But again, books are important because of the knowledge they give us and how they can help us better ourselves. In a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, again, His Eminence has said, books are the orchards of the scholars. What better orchard than that of Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi? Now, this orchard was not only an orchard because it was the fruit of years and years of struggle and striving and toiling and, as the story said, praying and fasting on behalf of the deceased so that he could collect money and buy many of those books we see in the library, but also because it was a process that he himself enjoyed to a great degree. It was an orchard. It's an orchard for a scholar because they walk through that orchard and they enjoy the words and the knowledge and the teachings of that book as if walking through a garden and smelling beautiful flowers and picking ripe, juicy, sweet fruits from the trees. Books benefit us mentally, psychologically, and sometimes physically and emotionally and spiritually. The greatest book to benefit from, obviously, is the Holy Quran, because there isn't any sort of knowledge that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not shared with us in that book. If He hadn't shared the knowledge with us, it would kind of defeat the objective of sending a book and telling us to refer to it in all of life situations. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the beauty of the worshippers, has said that if all the people in the West and all the people in the East perish, I will not feel lonesome as long as I have the Book of Allah and I can find company in the Book of Allah. The more we read the Holy Quran and the more we familiarize ourselves with it, the more we will feel like after a while we're establishing a dialogue with the Quran. Not only is Allah speaking to us, but we can speak to the Quran, and we can confide in it, and we can find refuge in it and comfort. And the Quran naturally speaks back to us because it has the Quran has an essence, has a spirit that is beyond these papers and these phrases written between two covers. It is as if it's an actual person that understands and feels and is able to converse with us and our souls. Inshallah ta'ala, may Allah increase our knowledge and may He increase the life of the scholars that have put so much effort into creating such invaluable resources for the Islamic nation. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.